You are listening to the News Project Podcast for the week of July 13th, 2020, brought to you by GNAT TV. This podcast brings you these stories. Rep. Kathleen James runs again, and COVID-19 rears its head in Manchester and Londonderry.
Kathleen James is running for re-election to the State House of Representatives seat she won in 2018. She is one of three candidates in the Democratic Party's primary election to be held on August 11th. The district, known as Bennington 4, is a two-member district and includes the towns of Manchester, Arlington, Sandgate, and most, though not all, of Sunderland. The top two vote-getters in the August primary will go on to compete in the general election in November, where the other current representative, Cynthia Browning, will also be on the ballot, running as an independent candidate. We had a chance to discuss her re-election bid with Representative James recently, and she talked about her past 2 years at the State House and the main issues she hopes to emphasize.
Well, like a lot of people in Vermont and around the country, I was really inspired to run by the 2016 election of Donald Trump and its fallout. I was motivated by policy issues. There were things like affordable childcare, paid family leave, and finding smart, strategic ways to fight climate change in a way that promotes a sustainable and renewable economy. Because those are the good-paying, fast-growing jobs of the future. And I felt like some of the issues that mattered to me weren't being talked about or weren't being focused on. But more importantly to me, I had kind of a personal reason for running, which is that I'm a Democrat, but I grew up in a very strongly Republican family. And in the time of Donald Trump, I really did not like the way that Americans were talking to each other and talking about politics, especially on social media. And so I ran for office in part because even at the local level, even here in our community and here in Vermont, I wanted to try to change that. I guess I wanted to be part of the solution and maybe try to prove to myself or try to prove to other people that we could do politics differently, even if we belong to a different party. That we could treat each other with respect and try to work across the aisle. And that was something I tried to do up in Montpelier in my first term. And I feel really good about how I accomplished that. You talk about politics, and I think before you go up to Montpelier, maybe you have the view that Montpelier is like the White House or like DC, that it's some sort of partisan boxing ring. And it is not that way at all. The State House is a very respectful, very collegial workplace. People treat each other with a lot of respect. People work across the aisle, particularly in committees. Most of the bills that leave committees leave on a unanimous or a close to unanimous vote. My committee, the Education Committee, we work together extremely well. And so that was a great introduction to me and how things work up in Montpelier. You get to know your Republican colleagues, and you like them and you respect them, and you talk to them all the time about their views. Another way I tried to get to know colleagues from other communities and from other parties was to get very involved in caucuses. So that was a great way that I was able to get my feet wet and really immerse myself in issues. I'm one of seven founders of the Bipartisan Tourism Caucus. That's a Democratic and Republican group that works to raise awareness and to raise funding for tourism at the state level, which certainly helps communities like Manchester and Arlington. So helped found that caucus and have been very active with that tourism group. I'm very active in the Bipartisan Rural Economic Development Working Group, which is a rural economic group that similarly works for communities to bring awareness and work on issues that impact towns like Manchester, Arlington, Sunderland, Sandgate. I'm one of the founding members of the Social Equity Caucus that got started last year around racial and social equity issues. And then I was very proud to be elected the leadership team of the Climate Solutions Caucus, where I really try to focus on issues that impact the climate economy. I mentioned earlier that climate issues are fundamentally economic issues, and I really try to talk about climate action in the framework of the economic impact it can have and the jobs that it can bring to our state. And I was really proud to win the Vermont Conservation Voters Rising Star Award this past year. So those are the ways in which I tried to not only dive into the issues, but to work across the aisle on issues that mattered to me. So one of the bills we passed last spring was the Rural Broadband Act. And I came home over our break last summer and was watching a bunch of communities over in Windham organize around this broadband bill and form a communications union district and do all this community organizing. And so I reached out to Laura Sebelia. She's an independent rep from Dover, and one of the folks that I really admire in the legislature, and somebody I look up to kind of as a mentor. And so Laura helped me organize a forum over here this past November. And I invited Laura and Rep. Robin Chestnut Tangerman to Manchester. And we had some folks from the Department of Public Service down, and also from a rural broadband group called EC Fiber. And I publicized the forum as best I could, got the word out on Front Porch Forum and in all the local newspapers. And I was really pleased to see we had, I don't know, maybe 30 people come from communities all over Bennington County. And from that group, we formed a task force. And from that task force, we took the concept of the Southern Vermont Communications Union District to voters at town meeting this past March all over Bennington County. We formed the Southern Vermont Communications Union District by voter approval. And the Communications Union District has since won a pretty hefty grant to start planning how we can bring broadband to all the underserved roads and regions across our county. And we've just been named one of Southern Vermont's 12 vital economic projects for the southern part of the state. So I'm really proud of that work, you know, because I kickstarted it. And it's really through the work of a lot of volunteers, a lot of volunteers. It's really on a roll. And I think we saw, especially during COVID, how important broadband is to people who want to work from home, to our schools, to educators, to telehealth, to businesses. And it's something where many, many downtown centers may have great broadband, but boy, you step out, you know, a couple houses on any given road and you might not have connectivity. And that's a real economic issue for our state and for our communities that we need to address. So I'm really proud of that work.
We have a few minutes left, and I just wanted to also touch upon education issues, since you were on the Education Committee in the House of Representatives. An immediate issue that whoever wins in November is going to be facing would be this apparently large and gaping hole in the Ed Fund budget, driven in part by the economic consequences of the COVID-19 pandemic. Roughly $100 million, as I understand it, although that number seems to shift around a lot. What are your thoughts on how that budget hole is going to be plugged? Is it simply a case of being able to use some of the federal CARES money, or is there going to have to be another way found to finance that?
Well, there's some things we know and some things we don't know. The good news, you know, if you can say that there's good news, is that the gap in the Ed Fund has dropped significantly. The first number we saw was 170 million. The latest projection is 100 million. The other, fact we have is that the legislature and the Ways and Means Committee has stated explicitly multiple times that that gap is not going to be filled by simply putting it onto the backs of property taxpayers. At one point, I had seen that if the legislature had chosen to do that, which was never considered or never an option, it could have meant a property tax increase of 22 cents. So that was taken off the table from the get-go. In the bill we passed, the yield bill, which the legislature passes every year, there were a number of ways or options stated for how we could address the gap when we come back in the fall. And some of those ways include using federal funds if we are allowed to do that. Right now, the CARES bill doesn't allow us to do that. We're still hoping that the guidelines may change. I can't speculate on whether that might happen. I know our federal delegation is lobbying for that and hoping that it will. I'm sure every state across the nation would like for that to happen. So that's one of the ways listed in the yield bill that we could use if federal guidelines change and we're allowed to do that. Another possibility listed is borrowing. Another possibility listed is that we could try to look for cost savings. Another possibility listed is that we could use the reserve. So I think it's too early to tell yet. One thing that we do know is that voters all over Vermont, most districts did get a budget passed at town meeting. And property tax bills for all of those districts, the vast majority of districts that did get their budget passed, property tax bills will start going out, as soon as they can. And I think based on those budgets that voters approved, we're looking at an average, this isn't, for our district necessarily, I don't think we know yet what our specific rate will be, but the average rate is set to be about 3 cents, I think, which is significantly better, obviously, than that, 22-cent rise that the legislature ruled out from the beginning. So I guess when we come back in August, we'll have a better financial picture, and we'll start looking at those seven options that the legislature set out in the bill that we passed, and we'll know more then.
We will be conducting a similar interview with Representative Browning shortly, and we'll get to hear her views and positions as well. For the GNet TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. The COVID-19 virus hit home in the North Shire, beginning apparently on the weekend of July 11th and 12th, when a handful of positive cases were identified, which expanded to about 35 or so by Monday, July 13th. With infections centered both in the Londonderry area and in Manchester. This outbreak led the Southwestern Vermont Medical Center to host a drive-by test site at the Riley Rink at Hunter Park in Manchester on Wednesday, July 15th, and a second one to be held on Thursday, July 16th. About 400 tests were administered on Wednesday between 9 a.m. and 3 p.m., which is about the same number the medical center usually does in a week. The medical center performs these tests regularly at its main hospital center in Bennington, although people wanting the test there need to register in advance, where the one in Manchester this week was first come, first served, with no advance registration needed. Depending on demand, the hospital may continue offering the tests in the future, possibly at its North Shire campus clinic. There are at least two kinds of tests for the COVID virus, one known as an antigen test, and the other referred to as a PCR test. Dr. Trey Dobson, SVMC's chief medical officer, explained the difference to us.
Well, you probably heard there's multiple types of tests right now, but this type of test is the one that's approved by the state. It's called a PCR test, and the way the specimen is collected is with a swab that goes way back into the nose. So not the front part of the nose like you may have for an influenza test, but way back. That's why it is slightly uncomfortable, but it's important because we need to catch part of the virus, which we know in that distance in the nose is detectable. Right. Well, the antigen test is quicker to perform, and the results are available in 15 to 20 minutes. There's multiple different manufacturers who manufacture an antigen test, and we use antigen tests with many other diseases. The problem is that it has to be honed in, the test itself. And right now, the sensitivity is not where we want it to be. In other words, there's too many false negatives with people being tested and turning out negative when in fact they actually have the disease. The PCR test is much more sensitive in that regard. Now, I do hope, and I think most everyone does, that these rapid tests will evolve, perhaps even over the next 3 to 4 months, and be available ubiquitous. I tell you, my goal is that you don't need a doctor's order and that you can get the test done at home. That's the way we can get on top of this pandemic. Mm-hmm. That's right. Our limiting factor right now, Andrew, is going to be supply of the specimen collection equipment. You might have read many times in the media where the testing equipment is not always available. Today, I will tell you, this morning we brought out 200 tests. We're clearly going to run out of those in a couple of hours. We are trying to contact the state and to get more available, at least by this evening, if not by noon today, so we can keep functioning. If we have to shut down today, I just hope people will be patient and understanding that we're doing the best we can, and we will open right back up as soon as we get more of this testing material.
When the testing opened at 9 a.m. on July 15th at Briley Rink, there was already a long line of cars waiting. The tests will be evaluated as quickly as possible, said Leslie Keefe, SVMC's Vice President of Corporate Development, who was on hand to help out.
The anticipated turnaround time on the test, is that like a week?
24 to 48 hours, typically. Could be up to 72, but we say within 24 to 48.
And they'll be tested down at the hospital?
Oh, we've been testing since March. Yes, drive-up testing.
Okay, so the actual tests will be run at the hospital?
We run them, but then we send them to UVM for the results. A lot of capacity. We brought 200 tests today. We will have more if we need it. And we can do pediatric testing as well here today.
And how quickly was the hospital able to ramp up this event here?
Within 24 hours we did it. Actually, it was less than 24 hours. It was yesterday afternoon. We had held incident command at 9 a.m. yesterday morning. And by the afternoon, the Riley Rink, John Larson, John O'Keefe, the town manager, the chief of police, everyone met with our team here, and this was developed.
And you're prepared to stay here for several days?
For as many days as possible.
Everyone's going to test it?
Yes.
So they want one?
Yes.
And anyone can show up? It's
anybody, yes.
Not just from
no,
around the
no,
area?
No, we have a series of questions and informational sheets that we're asking people if they were exposed. The typical wait time is 7 days for symptoms to progress. That's why they say if you've been exposed, wait 7 days and then get tested. Because if you're tested too early, it could come back negative, but you still, you know, have symptoms later on. So it's that 7 day wait period that's so critical before testing, if you've been exposed.
Don Penge of Manchester is one of those waiting in line, and he told us why he decided to swing by and get a test.
Well, just wanted to be sure I was safe and that my family would stay safe.
Did you have any concerns you might have been exposed to?
I contact a lot of people throughout the day and work, so I thought it was a good idea to try it.
Okay. A pop-up test site was also in place up in Londonderry at the Floodbrook School, conducted by the state's Department of Health. Traffic seemed a little less busy there that morning, although there had already been pop-up tests offered earlier at the school, and more are planned to be administered at the Grace Cottage Hospital in nearby Townsend. We had a chance to talk with Dana Zazinski, the Director of Student Services at Floodbrook School, who had just gotten her test.
Yes. Hi.
What was it like?
It was really easy. It didn't take more than 10 seconds to check in. And then you sit in a chair, take your mask off your nose, hold your head up, close your eyes for about 15 seconds, your eyes water, and then they say, you're done. And it was easy, and I guess I'll get results within 4 days.
Is this the first time you've been through this experience?
It is the first time, and hopefully the last. But it was really easy. If you have to get it done, it's nothing to be fearful about.
Word of the outbreak had emerged earlier for the Manchester Medical Center, which had conducted the antigen tests and started seeing more positive identifications of COVID beginning on July 1st and escalating the following weekend. By Wednesday, July 15th, they had seen 58 positive tests, which are considered presumptive positives by the state health department, which likes to have a confirmation by a PCR test before confirming a new infection. The positive antigen test is usually reliable when it comes to identifying an infection, but the state health department has concerns about false negatives. In other words, they don't consider the antigen test is totally reliable when it comes to ensuring a patient does not have the coronavirus. Doctors Janelle Kittredge and John Mallard of Manchester Urgent Care discussed that point and more at a press conference held Wednesday afternoon.
Using our antigen, that was on July 1st, so that was a one. And for the next 9 days, we really didn't see any positives. We averaged anywhere between 25 and 35 tests per day, and with all those tests, they were negative. On July 10th, we had another positive, and on that day, we tested 17. So if you look at it, it's really only like a 5.8%. And that's what we call right now, we kind of say when the wave started, right? So you think of it as July 10th is when we started to see the wave. On the 11th, we had three positives, and we had 36 people that were tested. On the 12th, we had 26 positives, and we had 76 tested. On the 13th, 7 positives, 74 tested, so we're kind of ramping up on the amount we're able to test in one day. And on the 14th, we had 21 positives and 64 tested. And that's a 33%, so that's a pretty significant number of the population. So since we began testing, our first time that we started to test was actually on 5/20 of this year. And we have tested right now, we are close to 800 tests that have been run. Of those 800 tests, we're right around 59 positive at this particular point. So if you look at that across the entire board, that's right around 8% since we've started testing on 5/20. But since the wave really began, we're right around 23% are positive. So out of every 100 people right now, we're seeing about 33 are positive. And remember, even we're testing patients that have come in, they've been positive. They then are bringing in their loved ones, their close network of friends, people that they're reaching out to say, hey, I'm positive, we need to go get tested. So, you know, these numbers could be higher than the overall general population, because it is a group of people that's talking amongst themselves that are having their friends and loved ones come in and get tested.
Okay, so now there's been question about the type of testing that we are utilizing. When it comes to the coronavirus, there are three types of tests that we are utilizing for this particular situation. We have an antigen test. We have a PCR, which means polymerase chain reaction test. And we have an antibody test. The antigen test is the rapid that we use here. We get a 15-minute turnaround time. It's a swab in the nasal cavity. The nasopharyngeal test is the PCR. That's the one that goes to the State Department, UVM Medical Center Lab, etc. That's also a deeper, what we call a nasopharyngeal swab. Then we have an antibody test, which is a blood test. So there's a lot of confusion as to what those are and what they do. So in an acute infection, right now during the acute phase of this pandemic, we want to know, are you actively infected? That would be with the antigen test and the PCR. Are you actively carrying virus? Antibody test is helpful down the road. Have you become infected at some point in time? It does not tell us if you're actively infected. So the way that you can look at it is this. You know, and I will also say that the antigen testing analyzer that we use here in our facility, those results are recognized by every other state in this union as a confirmed positive test. Vermont is the one that doesn't. Vermont's not familiar with this process, so that's where there's been some recent question. The PCR test is the one that takes a few days to grow out. It's kind of like a culture. When somebody says we're going to send this for culture, it's because they're going to grow out whatever issue we have there. It's a little more sensitive. And then again, we won't touch on the antibody test right now. So the antigen test, if you think of it, I liken this to a soccer analogy. If you look at your antigen as your striker, right? So the antigen means virus or enemy, okay? So your striker is like the fastest moving little player. It moves fast and we want to control it fast. The antigen, the striker, if they make a goal, 100% it's a goal. If we have a positive, 100% it's a positive. There's no error. You make that goal, you make that goal. The PCR, same thing. If we have, the PCR is kind of like our halfback, okay? It's a little more
is a little more specific. There's a little bit more stamina, but it's a little slower. But if your halfback makes a goal, it's 100%. There's no question. If our antibody test is your defense, and then we people, we're the goalie. So if the question has been recently, is our testing capacity accurate? Are we doing it accurately? Yes. There's no difference between our striker making the goal and our halfback making the goal. It's a goal. Where the difference lies is in the false negative. So our striker has a 12% chance of being missed. We miss it 12% of the time, so we have a false negative. If you have symptoms, I may miss you 12% if you get a negative. That's a false negative. Our halfback has a 6% chance of missing it. So that's why we confirm it with one that's a little bit more specific, but not necessarily more reliable. It just gives us we tighten up the miss rate. Where our antibodies come in, that's our defense. So when you've been exposed by the antigen, and your striker and your halfback know that team, you're playing against a really competitive team. You know their plays. You know how they're going to play. The defense has been watching their plays and are ready. Like, we're ready to fight that. We're ready to play this game because we've watched how you play, so that we can protect our goalie. And you can have decades of that kind of preseason training, if you will. So that's the majority of what most viruses, when we like have a vaccination, that's like giving us preseason training. You have a vaccination, we're introducing this virus, this antigen, that gives us time, gives our bodies time to get our defense ready. Those are the antibodies, is that we can mitigate. We need to stop active spread. You cannot do that if I have to wait 3 to 10 days to get a result back. Because most people think going home and being good means maybe just having a couple friends over. That's not enough.
Right.
We need to have total isolation. If we don't have people to spread this to, we don't have a pandemic. If I'm not spreading respiratory droplets to you, we don't have a pandemic. If I can pull you out of circulation really early, before you've had a chance while you're in your contagious phase to pass it to other people, let's stop that chain. But I can't wait 3 to 10 days.
Their advice was that people around the North Shire should double down on safety measures like wearing a good protective mask, social distancing, and avoiding unnecessary travel and possible exposures to others who may be carrying the virus and not know it. It's time to get back to the basics in order to defeat the COVID-19 virus, they said.
I think that if all the folks who came into Vermont around the 4th of July had been wearing masks and practicing social distancing and washing hands, etc., we probably wouldn't be seeing this outbreak today.
I'm not pinning it on out-of-staters, not even real closely. You know, it's not just out-of-state coming in. It's our own lax. It's the guidelines. People think, you know, they've been given the guidelines. When we opened up phase one in May, the numbers were, you know, it felt very decent and stable. But even then I was like, whoa, we are way too soon. Because folks that aren't in this day in and day out are listening, okay, what is it that I can do now? Oh, okay, so I can have 10 people? Okay, I'm gonna do 10 people. Because they're under the assumption, and rightly so, because that's what we've been telling people, is that, okay, 10 people, we're good with that. Uh-uh, that's 10 people that I can infect.
Yeah.
So it's 10. Not just the out-of-staters. Yes, but traveling definitely makes it worse, but we have locals that are traveling.
Yeah, that's the thing. We have a lot of locals that travel now.
And people will say, but I've been doing so good. I only went to New Jersey for 4 days, and then I came back. Or I only went to dinner 3 times. Because that's what we're telling them is okay to do. From a medical, scientific, virology standpoint, it's not okay to do. We can still live our lives. We can still go to work. Our kids can still do school, but we can't pretend like there's no virus. We have to be smart. I do not want our economy to close down. I do not want our kids to not go to school. Our kids have to go to school. I have 4 of them. God help me. They need to go to school. But we can't do it blindly. We have to wear the seatbelt. You got to lock the doors. You got to do the things that we know are going to make us not get hurt and sick. It's actually not rocket science.
On Thursday, July 16th, there was another large crowd at the Riley Rink getting more tests, and hospital officials were anticipating that another 400 tests would probably be administered by the end of the day on Thursday. They were also planning to hold another day of testing on Friday, July 17th, at the Riley Rink as well. We'll be continuing to follow the story as events go along and follow up with more information as it becomes available. For the GNet TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Thanks for listening local. For more local content, visit GNAT.tv.